Okay. The first thing I want to speak about is a little complicated, but so you have to pay attention. But I think that the message and the topic is important enough to hear about. And that's the following. The Torah tells us concerning marriage, ki yikach ish isha, when a man will take a woman. It doesn't say exactly how you do that, right? Maybe you club her and drag her by her hair into a cave or whatever, but it just says a man will take a woman. So how do we know how you affect a marriage? Okay. So the Gemara in Kiddushin says that we learn that you affect a marriage by the man giving the woman something of value, money or something worth money. The meaning is to give a ring, but anything already affects a marriage. And we know it from this week's Sedra, because the Torah says concerning the buying of the field of Ephraim, where Avram eventually buried Sarah, it says, Kesef hasadeh kach mimeni. Take the money for the field. Kach. So there's one of the 13 rules with which we learn things from the Torah is called Gzeirah Shavah. Gzeirah Shavah means where a word in this place is similar to a word in a different place, and the Torah wrote them similar in order to tell us that we learn the laws of one from the laws of the other. So therefore, just like by when Avraham Avinu bought the field of Ephraim for burying his wife, it says, take the money. So too, that's how you take a woman, by giving her money or something worth money. Okay? Okay, this mentions already. Shir sponsored by Maxine Aloof in memory of her mother, Esther Bashlomo, whose yahrzeit is Kaf Ches Cheshvan next week, and her grandmother, Fega Machla Bas Yoshua Hirsch, whose yahrzeit is Shivasar B'Cheshvan, which was yesterday. Okay. So that's how we learn that you affect a marriage by giving money or something of value. People who would like to detract from the Torah say, you see, that's how what the rabbis thought of marriage. Marriage is like buying a piece of real estate. You buy a piece of field, you buy a woman, right? She is just a commodity. It seems to reduce a woman to a piece of dirt, right? That, you know, buy a field, buy a woman, right? That's marriage. So I'm going to explain to you why not only is there no question, but why this is the most relevant and auspicious place to learn marriage from. But take a little bit of explaining, so pay attention. First, we're going to have a nice preface before we get back to the answer to this. And the preface is going to include quite a few different things which don't seem to have any connection to any of this. But take my word for it, I know where I'm heading, and it does have connection. First question, and this will answer the question in the Sedra too. The Ibn Ezra asks the following question, as well as other Rishonim ask the same question. They give different answers. Why did the Torah spend so much time with such a lengthy description of how Avraham bought the burial place for Sarah? Usually the Torah is very concise, short, to the point. It could have said in one sentence, and Avraham bought the place from Ephron Achiti for 400 shekel, period. He had to go through all the back and forth, what he said and what he said, and finally how he did it. Why? Why is the Torah so verbose over here? Why did it go into such detail? So the Ibn Ezra says the reason is because the Torah wanted us to impress upon us how important Eretz Yisrael is, not only for the living, but even for the dead to be buried there. You see how much trouble and how much expense Avraham Avinu went to bury Sarah in Eretz Yisrael, right? So it obviously impresses us with how important it must have been. It was worth going through all that bother and all that expense to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is so special even to be buried in, not only to the living, even to the dead. That's the Ibn Ezra. The Ramban asks on this Ibn Ezra a very simple question. He says, I agree with you that Eretz Yisrael is special and it's special to be buried there, but you don't see it from this parsha. Why not? If Sara Imenu had died in Flatbush, and Avraham Avinu went to such an expense and such a bother to ship her body to Eretz Yisrael, then I would understand that being buried in Eretz Yisrael is a very special thing, worth the expense and worth the bother. But where did Sara Imenu die? In Eretz Yisrael, in Hebron. Where was she buried? Exactly where she died. What should Avraham Avinu have done? Ship her body to Timbuktu? You bury people where they die. So you don't see from here the specialness of Eretz Yisrael, because maybe he buried her there because that's where she died. Had she died in Timbuktu, he would have buried her in Timbuktu. That's the Ramban's question on the Ibn Ezra. Where do you see from the fact that Avraham went to such expense and such bother to bury her where he buried her that Eretz Yisrael is special? He buried her where he buried her because that's where she died. In order to answer this question on the Ibn Ezra, I want to start with a question on a Ramban, a different place. The Ramban says, and I'm not going to go into detail why it's like that, but take my word for it, that's the way it is, and there's an explanation too, but not for now. The Ramban says that even though we know that our avos and imahos kept the Torah before it was given, but they only kept it in Eretz Yisrael. When they were outside of Eretz Yisrael, they didn't necessarily keep the Torah. There's a reason for that, why that was the case. But in any case, that's what he says. And he says, therefore, when Yaakov Avinu was in Chutz La'aretz, by Laban, he was able to marry two sisters. Because they didn't keep the Torah. The Torah wasn't given yet. They were volunteering to keep it. They only volunteered to keep it in Eretz Yisrael. When they were outside of Eretz Yisrael, they didn't necessarily keep it, and therefore Yaakov could marry two sisters when he was in Chutz La'aretz. And says the Ramban, that's why Sara Imenu, that's why Rachel Imenu died before they came back to Eretz Yisrael. So Yaakov should not be married to two sisters in Eretz Yisrael. That's the Ramban. The obvious question, which everybody asks on this Ramban, is the following: how many of you ever been to Kever Rachel? Who is buried in Kever Rachel? Okay, not Grant, Rachel. Okay. And where is Kever Rachel? In Beis Lechem. Where is Beis Lechem? In the United States of America, in Jordan, in Syria. It's in Eretz Yisrael. Okay? It's in Eretz Yisrael. So what does the Ramban say that Rachel Imenu died before they came back to Eretz Yisrael? So he shouldn't be married to two sisters in Eretz Yisrael if Rachel Imenu died where she's buried, which happens to be Beis Lechem, which happens to be in Eretz Yisrael. What's the Ramban talking about? To answer that, I'm going to tell you a Chassam Sofer with the first of an explanation what he means. This land that we are in has many names. From the time of creation, it was called Eretz HaSgula, Eretz HaChayim, Eretz HaKodesh, all these names. For a while, it was conquered by the Canaanim, and it was called Eretz Canaan. It also is called Eretz Yisrael. When is it called Eretz Yisrael, and when does it really get the status of Eretz Yisrael? When the Jewish people own it, and for other purposes, when we are settled here. Until we conquered Eretz Yisrael from the Canaanim in the time of Yoshua, it did not have Kedushas Eretz Yisrael. It was Kodesh. It was a holy land. It had holiness for certain things. But the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, which has the idea, the implication, excuse me, of if you plant something here, then it's Kodesh, you have to take Truma and Miser. That didn't apply. If somebody planted something here before the Jewish people conquered Eretz Yisrael and settled it, it wasn't Chayiv and Trumas and Maestras. It didn't have the full Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael means Eretz Shel Yisrael, the land that belongs and is settled by the Jewish people. Certain mitzvahs don't even take effect unless most Jews live in Eretz Yisrael, and according to some, live in the places they're supposed to live according to tribe, according to the various Shvatim. Example of that mitzvah is Yovel. The mitzvah of Yovel, every 50 years, isn't even rabbinic. We have no rabbinic Yovel. We have Shemitah that could be rabbinic, maybe from the Torah. But Yovel is for sure not from the Torah, because Yovel depends on most Jews living in Eretz Yisrael, and according to some, living where each Shevet is supposed to live. So what do we see from there? This land has holiness, but different degrees of holiness. There's the holiness of Eretz HaKodesh. There's a mitzvah to live here even before the Jewish people conquered it. Avraham Avinu lived here. But it doesn't have the full holiness of agricultural holiness or whatever. It doesn't demand trumas and maestros or whatever until it becomes Eretz Shel Yisrael, which means a land that is conquered or owned by the Jewish people in the proper way and settled by the Jewish people. When we went into Golis, after Nebuchadnezzar, Golis Bavel, according to opinions in the Gemara, and pretty much we hold like that, the Kedusha was Bavel. Doesn't mean it became not a holy land, but it means that for Trumas and Maestras, during those 70 years, if somebody planted something here, you weren't Chayv and Truman Maestra, until we came back, and then we reclaimed the land, but given to us by the Persians, who were in charge, and then it became again liable to Trumas and Maestras, because again it became Eretz Shel Yisrael. In the time of Yaakov Avinu, which part of this land could be called Eretz Yisrael, as apart from Eretz HaKodesh, Eretz HaSkula, Eretz HaKnani, HaChiti? Only one part. Maris HaMachpel. The Chevron. Kiryas Arba. Why? Because that was the only part that belonged to a Jew, Avraham Avinu. The other rest of it was conquered by the Knanim and owned by them. So the only part, with certain exceptions, but right now that's what's relevant to us, was Kiryat Arba. That was called Eretz Yisrael. The rest of the land was called Eretz HaKodesh, Eretz HaKnani, call it what you want. But it wasn't Eretz Yisrael.
What about Shechem?
Shechem, yes, but that was again later, and that was after this fact.
Yaakov came back and he bought Shechem.
Right, but the Maisa, what's it called? Right, true. But Yerachal Imenu died right after that. The part that was already Eretz Yisrael, right, says the Chassam Sofer, was only Eretz, what's a Chevron, Kiryat Arba, whatever. That's what the Ramban means. The Avos could be only kept the Torah mandate that they accepted upon themselves to do it for sure, was in the parts of this land that already were considered Eretz Yisrael, the full Kedusha. Then they kept the Torah. If not, then they still had a choice. It was voluntary. It's always voluntary. The question is if they accepted upon themselves to do it or not. So that's what the Ramban says. Before he came back to Eretz Yisrael, which at that time was Hebron, she died on the way in Beis Lechem. That he shouldn't be married to two sisters in a place that had the full Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, which was owned by a Jew, meaning Avraham Avinu. Okay, now with all that information, now let's go back to the original question we had on the Ibn Ezra. The Ibn Ezra says that Avraham Avinu, the Torah tells us how much bother and how much expense Avraham Avinu went to, right, in burying Sarah to tell us how important Eretz Yisrael is for the living and the dead. The Ramban asks on that, what are you talking about? He buried her there because she died there. There's no proof that it's something special. He didn't bring her there from somewhere else. Now we'll answer the question based on the information we have. First, you have to understand what happened over here. Avraham Avinu says to B'nai Chet, as an introduction to his desire to buy a burial plot for his wife, the following. Ger v'toshav anochi imachem. I am a stranger and a resident. Now, what do you mean? So the Mefarshim explain, various Mefarshim, the Ramban, Reb Shamshon Shmuel Hirsch, others, say the following. In those days, and this is not even uncommon today, there were two kinds of burial plots in Hebron, which is common in a lot of places in the world. They had family plots that were owned. The land was owned by the people who buried their dead there. The family owned that land, and they buried their dead there in perpetuity. One generation, the next generation, the next generation. That was a family plot. And usually it was in caves. So it was a family cave. And then there was a cemetery for people who didn't live in that city. Like a common, what's it called, public cemetery, where the people who were buried there died en route to somewhere else and happened to die in that city. Or they came to visit people there or came on business and died there. Right? This is not unusual. 100 years ago, the Telzer Rosh Hashiva, or Blazer Gordon, was on a fundraising trip in England, in London, and he died there. And he's buried right outside of London. I was there by his, not by his kvura, don't worry. I was there by his kever. I went to London one time and they took me to the cemetery. His OL is in a cemetery outside of London. And they couldn't ship his body back to Lithuania. So they buried him in where he died. So there are people who are buried, but they don't own the land. They don't get rights to the land where they're buried. Right? The family doesn't own that land. It's owned by the city. Except they have rights of burial. That's all. Okay. But the land doesn't belong to the people who are buried there. Avraham Avinu said like this, Ger v'toshova, you could look at me as a stranger here, and give me a plot in the common public cemetery for my wife. But I'm also a toshav, because this land was promised to me, and my family's going to be here for eternity. So I'm also a resident, even though you may not recognize that. So tnuli achuzas kever, give me a family plot, land that is zoned for a family plot, because I want to bury my wife in land that I own. I don't want her buried in public land, in the public cemetery. Now why do you say give me? Sell me, not give me. Because somebody who has land that is zoned for a family plot, it is very sacrilegious to sell it and make money on it. Right? It is not very nice. It's like selling your mother. You don't sell your mother. You don't sell your family plot. It's something sacred. You don't make business on that. So Avraham said, I know that nobody is going to want to publicly sell me a family plot, so be magnanimous and give it to me, and don't worry, I'll have gratitude. We'll see in 1 second what he told Ephraim. So he didn't phrase it as selling, because that would right away scare people away. Nobody wants to look like a person who sells his family plot for money, right? Such a mercenary person. So the people answer him, you are a great man, Avraham, but nothing doing. Ish mimenu eskivro lo yichla mincha. No one will hold back their grave from you. Meaning, you're not getting land. You get rights for burial. But the land will belong to the city, not to you. Avraham says, not acceptable. I know somebody who will sell his mother. Do anything for money. Ephraim, you set me up with him and I'll work it out that he'll sell me a family plot. Okay? And he also says, V'yitengli, I'm not going to make him look bad. So he's going to give me this family plot and I'm going to give him a present in return, money. Right? V'yitengli, that's what he says, he'll give me, right? Esmaras ha-machpela shirlo asher b'ksei sodehu b'kesef mole yitnenu li. With a full price, he'll give it to me. Now, if it's a full price, and he's selling it to him. No. Avraham says like this, we're not making any sale. You are magnanimously, Ephraim, giving me your family plot, which you didn't have anybody buried in yet. Adam and Chava were buried there. But it was set aside, it was zoned for his family plot. Ephraim says, Avraham, you're such an important person, I'll give you the family plot. Avraham says, have such gratitude that you gave me that family plot, I want to give you a present of money. Ephraim gets his money, Avraham gets the plot, Ephraim saves face, he didn't sell anything, he gave it as a present, and he got money as a present. Ephraim, and that's why, if you look at the parsha, every time they speak, they say, Shmoeinu Adoni, listen to me. Why? Not because they were deaf, but because they're hinting. They can't say out what really is going on. They can't say, sell me the plot, how much does it cost? That's mercenary, it's very demeaning. So they're talking in hints. Avraham says, listen carefully and you'll get the idea. I want you to give me Moras HaMachpelah. If you give it to me, I will in turn give you a present of money. Now Ephron understands. I'm giving it to you, and I'm getting a present in return. Ephron says, no deal. I don't like that. Why not? Because I can't then discern the price. You're giving me a present of money. I can't say, well, I want this kind of present. Then it's not a present anymore. So Ephron says, no, that's not. I don't think that's a good idea. Because then you can decide how much present you want to give me for the present that I gave you. Nothing doing. He says like this to him. He says, Shmaini, you listen carefully and you'll get the idea how I think we can do this. He says, I gave you the field, right? And the cave in the field. Okay? No, Shmaini Aduni, Hasodeh Nosati Loch, I've already decided to give you the field, the Hamo'ora Shirbo, and the cave that's in it. Ephron Avinu says, field? Who's talking about fields? I just want the cave. Ephron's hinting to him the following. The cave, the Svarim say, happened to be at the end of Ephron's field. The only access to that cave was through the field that Ephron owned. Ephron said like this, I'm more than happy to give you the field and the cave, okay? But you should know that if you don't have the field, there's no way without a helicopter that you can get to your cave. Because the only access is through my field, and I don't give permission for anybody to go over my field unless they buy the field from me. So Avraham now understands. Fields you can buy. There's nothing sacrilegious about buying a field. It happens to be the only access to the cave, which I'm giving you to for free. Don't pay me for the cave. Just pay me for the field. And the field is not a mercenary. It's fine to be mercenary about a field. So Avraham says, he gets the idea. He says, Kesef hasod nasati lo. We're not talking about caves anymore. I'll give you money for the field. And what's it called? That way, I'll own the access, and you're giving me the ma'ara. You gave me the burial plot, you saved face, you didn't make money on that, you weren't mercenary, and I'll buy the field from you. Tell me how much you want for the field. He said, what's 400 shekel, which is about $3-4 million between friends? Now Ephron got what he wanted. And he knew that Avraham Avinu wanted this burial plot, and he'll pay anything for it, and he's a rich man. So Avraham gave him the 400 shekel, gave him $3 million for a field, right, in order to get access to the cave, which he got for free. That is the parsha. Now let's see what the Ibn Ezra say. Based on what we learned till now, Avraham Avinu could have buried Sarah in the same ground, same city, without any bother and without any expense, if he would have been willing to bury her in their land and not own the land. Why did he go to the trouble and the expense of buying the land? Because he wanted to make it Eretz Yisrael. Because if he hadn't bought the land, it would have been Eretz HaKodesh, but it wouldn't have had the full holiness of being Eretz Yisrael, the land that belongs to a Jew. Says the Ibn Ezra, we see how valuable Eretz Yisrael is to the living and the dead. Not Eretz HaKodesh. But Eretz Yisrael, he could have buried her in the same place without bother and without expense had he not wanted to elevate the land to Eretz Yisrael. But we see from there that being buried in Eretz Yisrael, in that full kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, is special and worth the bother and the expense. Now we can see why we learn marriage from here. When Avraham Avinu bought this field, right, he bought it because he wanted a real estate deal. He wanted a field? No. He had no desire for a field at all. The only reason he bought the field is in order that he should be able to bury his wife in land that belonged to him that became Eretz Yisrael. Okay? So therefore, this was not a mercenary real estate deal. This was an idea where by bonding your soul to the land, you elevate the holiness of the land. And once the land is elevated, and that's what it says in the parasha, by Yochum stay Ephron. The Sod of Ephron had an elevation. What was it elevated? Became Eretz Yisrael. Became with its full holiness. And then burying Sarah in that elevated Kedusha was beneficial to her. So what do you see from this deal? That the Eretz Yisrael is... was the deal? Avraham gave money. And in that way, he bonded his soul to the land and elevated the land, and then the land elevated him. It's a symbiotic relationship. You make it Eretz Yisrael, and now you're living in Eretz Yisrael. We're burying Eretz Yisrael extra special. That's what marriage is. Two people bond their souls together, each one supplements and complements the other one, elevates the other one into a new symbiotic relationship. That's exactly why we learn marriage from this place, because it wasn't buying a field because Avraham Avinu wanted to own a field. It had nothing to do with buying a piece of property. It had to do with bonding his soul to the soul of the land and the soul of the land to him, in order that the land should become more holy because it had a connection to him, and he and his wife should be more holy because they have a connection to the land. That's exactly what marriage is. That's what we learn from this parasha. So it's not only not a question. Right? You see, the rabbi said that buying a woman is like buying a piece of real estate, but just the opposite. This is the most proper place, right, to learn marriage from. This is exactly what marriage is. Okay, any questions on that? Okay, next. Says that, what's it called, that Rivka was tested with her chesed. Will she give Eliezer a drink? Okay? And his camels too. Okay? That's the main thing that Avram and Yitzchak are looking for in a wife, that she is a kind person. What about, is she frum? Is she Shomer Shabbos? Is she, what's it called, or some more important things? Does she stack her dishes properly, or does she have the right color tablecloth? I mean, there are really important things besides, is she kind and gives drinks to camels?
She's Betoshel Betuel. What's Shomer Shabbos?
Yeah, what's that?
Father was a...
Right. I'm just saying, is she frum? She believe in God. Did you ask her if you believe in God? Right? She keeps Sheva Mitzvah Noah? Okay, she gives drinks to camels, but it does other things to look for. Right, you're looking for a shidduch for your son or your daughter, and they tell you on the phone, "Oh, he's a very, very kind person, Rabbi, very nice." But there's other things, you know, to ask about, and usually, if that's what they say, that means that forget about the rest of it. Yeah,
I'd like to ask a question just on Sarah. What was she doing in Hebron? Avram lived in Beersheba. What was she doing in Hebron?
No, they lived in Kiryat Arba. He had gone to Beersheba. Afterwards, he returned to Be'er Sheva, right, after the Akedah. But the Maisha, they had lived in Kiryat Arba all the time. He was on his way when he heard that Sarah had died.
I was always told, I always read, that the chesed that she showed was really something special. He'd come with 10 camels. Each camel would drink 22 gallons of water. And she drew the water. To draw 220 gallons is no mean feat. So it was a special sort of chesed. She didn't sort of do the first camel and say, "You carry on." She carried to the bitter end.
Okay. So she was an exemplary chesed doer. But aren't there other things that are important if you're going to be Yitzchak's wife?
That's Avraham's main feature, his chesed. So she was a kala Avrahamit Avraham.
Okay, but he wasn't. It was Avraham's daughter-in-law. It was Yitzchak's wife. Okay. Okay, I hear, but let me tell you what I think, because I get paid to do this year. Let me make the question even stronger. Chesed's very nice, right? To be a kind person. There are plenty of people in this world, lechora, don't believe in God and do chesed. And there are people who do believe in God and don't do so much chesed. Okay. Yet, the Medrash says that the two are connected. Kol mi shegomel chesed, whoever is a person who performs kindness, chesed, ki'ilu molde b'chol anisim she'osa HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'tzeotziyo mi'mitzrayim. It's as if he believes in all the miracles that God did when they left Egypt. B'chol she'eno gomel chesed, somebody who doesn't do kindness, Ki'ilu Kofer, he's like he's an atheist. Doesn't believe. Now, I understand chesed is a nice thing. That's being Adam Lechaveiro. It's between man and man. What does chesed have to do with emunah? Like I said, there's people believe who don't do chesed, and people don't believe who do chesed. They don't seem to have a correlation. But because you don't do chesed, it's like you don't believe. What does that mean? So let's discuss what chesed is. Go back to last week's parsha. I don't think we spoke, but last time I was here was before Lech Lecho, we didn't speak about Vayera. Okay. speak about these things so many places, I don't remember where I said what I where or what I said, or even where I was. Avraham Avinu, I ask you two questions about Avraham Avinu, this great Baal Chesed. Okay, Avraham Avinu is the paradigm of Chesed. Let's see, was he? He had guests. He invited to his house for a meal. Avraham Avinu had this beautiful house. Don't bet you, that wasn't a teepee, you know, with four doors. It was this big house, like they have these tents for Lahavdil Avelim or Simchas, right? They have chasanas in tents. There's a chasana hall on the way here that I pass all the time. It's a big tent, but it's beautiful. Avraham Avinu had this beautiful house with four doors, air-conditioned, right? Very airy. Brings the guests home. It's a hot day. Where does he put them? Under a tree, and brings the food out to them. Now, I know if I invite guests to my house and I brought them home and put them under a tree at a picnic table outside in my front yard, my wife would have my head. What are you doing? What kind of host leaves his guests on a picnic table on the front yard? You have a picnic. It's one thing. You invite guests to your house. Bring them into the house. Treat them royally. So Avraham Avinu leaves them outside. So maybe he did something wrong. Chazal say, because he fed them under the tree, we merited to get the mitzvah of sukkah later on. So obviously it was a good thing. Why? Why is it a good thing to leave them under a tree? Next question. Avraham Avinu, chesed, says the Michta Eliyahu. What is the bottom line of being a Baal Chesed? Being a giver, not a taker. There are two kinds of people in this world, givers and takers. It's better to be a giver than a taker. A person should always try, everybody should try to be givers. So first of all, a good question on that one. If everybody's going to be givers, who are they going to give to? We have to at least elect a symbolic taker, right? A token taker to take. That, well, somebody has to take, otherwise who can you give? One question. Second question. Avraham Avinu was a giver, not a taker. Where do we see that? When Melech Sodom offered him all the booty of the war, he said, I'm not taking anything, not a shoelace, not a nothing. A thread, a shoelace, zero. Good, very good. I'm not a taker, I'm a giver. Great. Remember back in Lech Lecha, Avraham Avinu took presents from Paro? Paro gave him a lot of presents. He didn't say, oh, I'm sorry, I don't take from anybody. He took very nicely. In that same parasha, according to some opinions, Malki Tzedek gave Meiser to Avraham Avinu. He brought out Lechem V'yayin, and he brought out also Meiser, and he gave it to Avraham, according to some. Avraham was a Kohen, he gave it to Avraham. Avraham didn't say, I'm sorry, don't take presents. Took it. In last week's Sedra, Avraham Avinu took from Avimelech. Avimelech gave him presents, gave a lot of money to Sarah. They didn't say, sorry, we're givers, not takers, we don't take anything. They took, that's fine. So out of four instances, Avraham Avinu took three out of four times, and only one time didn't. What kind of giver is he, not a taker? Seems to me like a good taker, too. According to the Mitzvah Eliyahu, what's he about chesed? If he's a taker, it takes three out of four times. One time he didn't, all of a sudden he's not a taker. The basic idea is that chesed doesn't really depend if you're giving something out or receiving it. It depends on your attitude. That you can put yourself in somebody else's place and not think about yourself, but think about someone else. And therefore, sometimes receiving in thinking of somebody else is really giving them. And sometimes what appears to be giving out is really taking. I'll explain to you now how that works. But that's the idea. Chesed means I don't think about myself. I think about someone else. And I put myself in their shoes, and they're what's important. I divest myself of my ego, myself, and I'm totally, totally thinking about someone else. Okay, now let's see how it's possible to appear to be the giver and you're really a taker. I'll give you two examples. And then we'll see what Avraham did. One example. Tell you from my experience. Okay, this was years ago when I didn't have people that I stayed by, you know, that I knew or whatever. Sometimes I would be taken to Chutz Laretz, and they put me up by somebody who didn't know me, and I didn't know them. And these people, with good intentions, wanted to be good hosts. Now, I don't know, when I travel, right, I usually travel overnight, come in, that's a goal, or if I travel during the day, come in late at night. The first thing I want, and the only thing I'm interested in, where is the nearest bed? I am dead tired. I usually can't sleep so much on the plane. Dead tired. Okay? On the other hand, people want to be good hosts. What kind of good host sends his guest to bed right away? So they prepare a lavish spread, nice big meal. Meanwhile, I ate four times on the plane already, right? I don't even want to look at food for the next few days, right? But how can I not, you know, let them feel like they're good hosts? And what good host sets his guest down for 5 minutes to eat and then sends him to sleep? You have to speak for an hour. So I'm sitting with toothpicks in my eyelids to hold them open and letting these people feel like they're good hosts, because that's what they want to feel like. They didn't want to feel like they did me bad, you know, and sent me to bed right away. Now, who in that situation appears to be the giver? The host. But who's really the giver? Me. I'm giving them the ability to pat themselves on the back and say they were good hosts. And again, their intentions are 100% good. But the truth is, if they really wanted to give, they would understand what I really needed, and so they wouldn't look like great hosts, but I would get what I needed, if that was really their intention. Okay? They'd be sensitive to the fact what I needed, not what they needed to feel good hosts. I'll give you another example, maybe you can relate to better. You ever go visit somebody in the hospital? Spend money, time, finally you get to the hospital, and the person is asleep. What a chutzpah. I came to visit you. What are you asleep? Now, if you're asleep, you don't even know I'm not here. And I don't get my mitzvah.
Have to wake him up.
So, my wife tells me, Baruch Hashem, I haven't been in the hospital too much. Now I can't say that, but a few years ago, but since then I haven't. Baruch Hashem, Bliyayin Hara. She was in the hospital 10 times having children. We have 11 children, Kedayin Hara. Two of them are twins, so she was there 10 times having children. She told me the hardest thing in the hospital is to get to sleep. And the thing that you want the most is to get to sleep over there. But as soon as you finally get to sleep, they wake you up to take sleeping pills. That's what the nurses do. So it's almost impossible to get to sleep in the hospital. Somebody who's sick obviously needs rest. So the person's asleep. What's best for them under most circumstances, sometimes there's exceptions to the rule, that the person, it's good for them to be asleep. But it's not good for me. I want my mitzvah. I came here to visit the sick. So if you're refined, you send the nurse in to see if they're really asleep, meaning wake them up, I'm here. If you're not so refined, you walk into the room, knock over a chair, make a lot of noise, they wake up and they say, well, sorry, I didn't mean to wake you. But you did mean to wake them because you want your mitzvah. In that situation, who appears to be the giver? The visitor. Who appears to be the taker? The sick person. But who's really the giver? The sick person is giving the visitor the chance to do a mitzvah at his expense. So giving and taking doesn't necessarily mean who looks like he's giving out and who's receiving. It goes way beyond that. If you understand that chesed is doing what's good for someone else and not taking yourself into consideration, taking their needs into consideration. Now let's get to Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu sees three people on the road traveling in a rush. He says, please, come. You're traveling. Vistami, you need a good meal, right? You want to wash up a little bit. I know, however, that people in a rush do not want to enter somebody's house. Because once they're in the house, they feel they'll never get out of there. Right? You're on the way to the airport. You're on the way to an appointment. Somebody says, stop my house just for a few minutes. Right away, you think to yourself, I'll never get out of here. Right? I'm never going to make the appointment. Because once you're in somebody's house, you can't just pick yourself up and leave. And you're sitting on shpilkas, they're looking at your watch the whole time, when can I get out of here? So Avraham Avinu said, I want this to be for your sake. And I know you're in a rush. I'm not going to bring you into my house. You're going to eat under a tree. Whenever you're ready, leave. And I think that's why he offered them milchiks and fleishiks. Because he said, you know what? We have milchiks ready, cheese, milk. You want to eat and run? Go. You're not in such a rush. You just told me that to make me feel good. You have time? We're making a nice fleishig meal. Stick around. That's what I told them. Whatever you want. I'm doing it for your sake. I'm tailor-making my chesed to you, not to me. I will look like a better host if I bring you in my house, but that's not what you need. So I'm totally ignoring my needs, totally what are your needs. That's called giving. And that's called giving the real way what kindness is, not because I'm doing it to fulfill my needs, I'm doing it to fulfill your needs, and I understand what your needs are. Now let's go to the other. And that's why we got the mitzvah sukkah. Because the mitzvah sukkah has two parts to it. One is it's a remembrance of the anoni hakavod, of God's spiritual clouds of glory. That was very nice on God's level, but a human being needs to see a roof over his head. He needs to see walls. Otherwise, how can you live in a cloud, right? You don't feel comfortable. So the Ribbono Shel Olam, because Avraham Avinu put himself out to feel the needs of these angels, right? The needs of what they needed then was as people. God also felt our needs and said, I'm not just going to give you clouds of glory, I'm going to give you something that fulfills your need to be able to see walls and a roof above you too, aside from the clouds of glory. Those are the real things that protect you. But a human being has to see something. So I'll give you something to see. Because Avraham Avinu was able to be sensitive to the needs of his guests, I can be sensitive to your needs. Okay. Now we go to the other extreme.
Who said this, Rabbi?
Who said it? I just did.
This is the original.
When it's not, I usually tell you who said it. Okay. So if you have any complaints about it, it's me. Okay. Now let's go to the other side. How can you be a taker and really be a giver? First, there's three ways that I can think of. Maybe there are more, but the three fit the three times that Avraham Avinu took. Firstly, you take in order to give. I'll give you an example. When I was a teenager, so I lived in Miami. And in Miami, there weren't too many big gedolim or rebbeim or anybody. What's it called? Miami is Miami at the time. Now it maybe it's different. And the Satmar Rebbe, the old Satmar Rebbe, Reb Yo, used to spend his winters in Miami. He was a big rub or whatever, and I was a teenager, and I decided I'm going to go to this Mr. Moskowitz's house who hosted him. I want to see this big rabbi, right, this Satmar Rebbe. So I went there. And I sat in the room there where, and I watched. What's it called? Every once in a while he came out. He had a room. There was a waiting room. And every once in a while he came out. And I noticed when he came out, he had this big robe and with gigantic pockets in it. And the pockets were stuffed with money. Not $1 bills. $100 bills stuffed in the pockets. I remember thinking to myself as a teenager, when I grow up, I'm going to be a Rebbe. This is a great parnasa. The didn't work out, but in any case, so I said to myself, "Wow, what's it called? This rabbi knows how to take." Mm-hmm. Then I saw, because people would come to him, they would ask him for a bracha, and the rich people came, and they took out a few $100, stuffed it, and he put it in his pocket. Didn't look at it, stuffed in his pocket. People came with a kvittel, more money. Then I noticed poor people came, crying, dressed almost in rags. And I would see, through the door, he would put his hand in his pocket, pull out a wad of bills, not even looking at them, what they were, hand it over to the guy, finish. Until the pockets were empty. More rich people came, pockets got filled up. Could you say the Satmar Rebbe was a taker? No. He was a clearinghouse. Right? People gave him what they wanted to give him. He didn't ask for it. They wanted to give him. And then he had money. He didn't have his own money to give these poor people. Now he had money to give the poor people. We're not talking about Robin Hood, who steals from the rich. The rich people give it to you because you want to. So he took in order to be able to give. That's called giving. Taking in order to give is giving. And let me tell you something interesting that I once thought of. It says that the symbol, according to some, of kindness, of chesed, is a good heart. Lev tov. One of the reasons is because the heart is a giver. The heart gives out blood to the whole body. But if you ever learn biology, you know the heart takes in as much blood as it gives out. The heart takes in to the ventricles, what's it called, the blood, and then it gives out through the auricles the blood. So, right, doctor? In any case, so the heart takes in as much as it gives out, so why is it a giver? It's as much a taker. And the answer is, because the blood supply of the heart is not what the heart takes inside the heart. That blood supply is on the outside of the heart. What the heart takes in is not for itself. Has no benefit from that. It's in order to send it to the lungs to get oxygenated, and then to send it out to the body again. So when the heart receives blood from the body, it's not for its sake. It's in order to be able to get the blood oxygenated again and then send it to the body. So it's taking in order to give. That's called giving. The heart is a giver. It doesn't take. What it takes for itself is not from the blood that takes from the whole body. That's from the blood that's sent to the heart and the veins and arteries on the surface of the heart. So the heart is a giver, even though it takes as much as it gives, but it takes in order to give. That's called giving. That's what Avram did with Paro. Avram Avinu was left Eretz Yisrael with a famine. He was destitute. It says that he couldn't pay his motel bills on the way down to Mitzrayim. He had to take it on credit. And he had students to feed, a wife to feed. God promised him that he'd bless him with riches. Comes to Mitzrayim, Taro takes away his wife, and all of a sudden this Paro wants to give him gifts. Avraham Avinu says, this is how God is keeping his promise. He's making me rich. That's a famous story of the guy who has total faith in God, right? And there's a flood, and the water is up to his ankles, and a boat comes by, and he says, get in. He says, no, I trust God. God's going to save me. Nope, the boat goes away. Now the water's up to his waist, right? Then there's a bigger boat that comes. They tell him, get in. He says, no, I have trust in God, and God's going to save me. Now the water is already over his head. He comes up to the roof. A helicopter comes by. They yell down to him, hold on to the rope, we're going to save you. He says, no, I have faith that God's going to save me. Meanwhile, the water goes over the roof. He drowns. Comes before the heavenly court, and he says to God, God, I had such implicit faith in you. Why did you let me die? Why didn't you save me? God said, I sent you two boats and a helicopter. What do you want? So, yeah, Avraham Avinu said, the Rebbeinu says, make you rich. He's not going to send care packages down from the heaven. This is the way God's making me rich, by taking the money from Paro. But he took it in order to pay his debts, in order to feed his family. He didn't take for himself. He took in order to give. He didn't have anything to give. You can't be a giver if you don't have anything. And here Paro wants to give him. So he takes from Paro. Next case, where taking is giving. When I became a rabbi in Miami, the first few months that I was there, I said to myself, I'm going to be a tzaddik. I was young at the time, and the salary the shul paid me was not great money, but it took care of my family's needs. It was sufficient. Rabbis usually get presents from congregants. At different times of the year, they give them before Yom Noroyim, people give the rabbi a present. Mechiras Chametz, they give the rabbi a present. Purim time, they come back from Eretz Yisrael, people bring a present back for the rabbi. This is usual. I said to myself, no way. I'm not taking anything from anybody. I live on my salary, and I'm Soni Matonis Yichya, person doesn't take presents, lives longer, I'm not going to take any presents. So my policy was, lasted only a few months, I don't take presents from anybody. People wanted to give me presents for Pesach, I don't take. Until one day, one of my elderly congregants came to me, said, Rabbi, you'll forgive me if I'm blunt, but I got to tell you something. You think you're a big tzaddik that you don't take presents from people here, but you're insulting these people because they want to have the honor of giving you a present, and you're telling them your presents are meaningless to me. Take the present. Give them the honor. Give them the respect of taking the present. You don't want to use it. That's your business. But at least accept it from them to give them the honor of accepting. And he was 100% right. Didn't have to convince me that much. From then on, I take presents. But he was right. And there's a Gemara that says that. The halacha is, we started out with marriage, that in order to effect a marriage, a man has to give a woman something. If the woman gives the man something and says, you are married to me, it's no effect. The man has to give the woman. There is a case, though, where a woman can give a man something, and the man can say, with what you gave me, I'm marrying you, and it's good. The case is Adam Chashuv, a very important person who usually doesn't take presents, and people vie to give him presents. A president, the king. People want to give the president presents that they should say, the president took a present from me. The king took a present from me. And it's worth money to them. So much that they're willing to pay somebody to be a go-between, to convince the king or the president to take their present. Doesn't take from everybody. I can say, I have a present in the White House. that I gave the president. It's a kavod for me. So it's worth it for me. And the president says, I'm sorry, I'm not interested in your present, right? Want to give me a watermelon, fine, but other things don't interest me. Whatever, where the president is. We'll just skip that. Somebody is willing to spend money to convince the president or the king to take his present. So it's worth money. So the king, the woman comes to the president and says, I want to give you this present. He says, fine. With the enjoyment I just gave you, by accepting your present, which is worth money, I am marrying you. She says, fine, and they're married. So even though the woman gave the president, he can mekadesh her with the enjoyment she got that he accepted her present. Because it has a market value. So that is the second way a person can take in order to give honor to the person he's taking from. I don't really want the thing. I don't need it. But I want to give you the respect and the honor of receiving something from you. Because you want to give it to me. That's how Avram took from Avimelech. Avimelech did something he was embarrassed about. He took Sarah, thinking she was Avram's sister. Found out it's his wife. He was a really moral person. And he felt terrible. He felt so ashamed. And he wanted to save face. So he gave Avram presents and he gave Sarah presents. And by accepting them, they said, you know what, no hard feelings. We understand you didn't do it on purpose. And we're bearing the hatchet. We hold no grudges. We'll take your presents and let you save face. So they took the presents to respect and honor Avimelech. Not for their sake. That's called giving. They gave Avimelech the covet of being able to save face because of what he did. Third case, and this is perhaps the most important. In every relationship, relationships are usually give and take. Sometimes this one gives, sometimes this one gives, sometimes this one takes, sometimes that's a usual relationship. Except by a Jewish marriage. Jewish women are known to be martyrs. What does that mean?
Huh? Polish ones.
Well, I don't know anyone. What does that mean? There's enough food for an army being served. And there's a husband and wife and a little child sitting at the table. And they serve the wife her portion. She says, no, give it to my child. Let me give it to your child. There's enough here for an army. The child's not going to starve if you don't eat. No, I can't eat. Give it to my child. That's called a martyr. I'll give you a real example. I hope my wife doesn't listen to this tape. But I tell my wife all the time, don't be a martyr. Why do you have to... She went... And before Rachel Imenu was yard site, to daven by Kever Rachel. Okay, she was there a few hours. So I asked her, daven for your husband? Yeah. Daven for your children? Yeah. Your grandchildren? Yeah. For people on the Moshav? Yeah. So did you daven for yourself? Oh, not every time. I thought, why do you have to be a martyr? You could daven for yourself too. There's no reason why you can't daven for yourself. Right? Why do you have to... That is... A Jewish wife-mother syndrome, to be a martyr. Now, on the surface, that seems very nice, but it's not. Because if a person in a relationship always wants to be the giver and not the taker, then they are relegating the other side to always be the taker and never be a giver. And that's very demeaning. Sometimes you have to take in order to enable the other person to be a giver, to give them some self-respect, that they're not always on the taking end. They can also give. That's why Avraham Avinu took from Malki Tzedek. Malki Tzedek wanted to give Meiser. There was no one he could give it to unless Avraham took it, because he was a Kohen. So to enable Malki Tzedek to give, Avraham took. Sometimes you have to take to enable the other person to give. Those are the three cases where taking is really giving. And in those cases, Avraham took, because that's giving. The only case he didn't take is where you couldn't say taking is giving. Melech Sodom wasn't honored, couldn't care less, he wanted everything for himself, thinks he was giving Avram a favor. Then Avram didn't take. I don't take. From you, it's pure taking. I don't take. Bottom line from all of this, chesed is the ability to divest yourself of your interests and be concerned about somebody else. Meaning that you can be objective and not subjective. They say, what's the difference between a mirror and a window? A window, you see the whole world. And a mirror, you see yourself. You know the difference between a window and a mirror? If you smear a little silver, a little kesef, on the window, it becomes a mirror. Meaning subjectivity, kesef. Kesef means desires, but also means money. A little money already makes you subjective, biased, and all you see is yourself. Take away that subjectivity, you can see the whole world. Same thing with God. Who can believe in God? Somebody who's objective. Because if you're subjective and you're only looking at yourself and what's good for you, I don't want to believe in God. Because God cramps my style. I'd rather do whatever I want to do. I'd rather fulfill all my desires. And if I believe in God and believe that He calls the shots, I can't do that. So unless I can be an objective person, I'm not going to be able to really see God. And therefore, a person who's who can do chesed, who has the ability to become objective and divest themselves of their bias about themselves and think about somebody else, they have the potential to believe in God. And somebody even believes in God but doesn't have that potential, eventually there's going to become a conflict between him and God because he looks at himself first, what he wants, what his bias is, and when God steps in the way, then I don't know anymore if I believe in you that much. So there's a tremendous correlation. The Mela, that was the test of Rivka. If she's really a balas chesed, that's what you said, it wasn't just do him a little favor. It was every little step along the way showed that she put herself in Eliezer's thing. Because the thing is like this. Why did she offer the camels? He didn't ask her for the camels. He asked her for a drink of water. She didn't offer it. So I think the Beis Halevi says the following. He says, Eliezer, he's a grown man, just a little girl, and he asked her for a drink. So she thought to herself, either the guy is really not nice, or he's sick, and he can't take a drink for himself. So he needs me to give it. So Eliezer drank from the water and left some over. Now she has this quandary. What do I do with the leftover water? If he's sick, if he's, what's it called, well, and I spill out the water, it's an insult to him. Right? Why am I spilling out the extra water? Drink it. Right? Elamai, I'm afraid that maybe he's sick and contagious. I can't drink it. If I spill it out, I may be embarrassing him. If I drink it, I may be getting some terrible disease. So know what she did? I'll give it to the camels. Camels can drink anything, you know. What's it called? They're not going to get sick. But if I just give, if I just give that little bit, yeah, just like give that little bit. They knew that there was something that spread the bubonic plague. They knew. Right? I'm saying then. But in any case, so if I only give the camels what he left over, he's going to get the idea. So I'm going to offer to give all his camels, all 220 gallons, in order not to hurt his feelings. So there she put himself in her in his place. That's that kind of chesed. Not just to do somebody a favor, but totally divest herself of her interests. She wasn't interested in doing all this work. But how could I not do it and hurt his feelings? Or whatever, and therefore she did it. So if somebody has that quality, then it's easy to teach them how to believe in God. Even if they don't believe right now, potentially they'll believe in God. So I'll bring them home, and Avraham and Yitzchak will teach you how to believe in God. That's not important right now. What's important is this the kind of woman, right, that has the potential to be a believer and the potential to divest herself of her own bias and her own subjectivity, then everything's open to her. If she's not, then nothing's open to her. That was the test.